So some weeks ago, as I was trying to decide on a scripture for this Sunday, when I thought we'd be blessing graduates, but as many, many children are coming to the end of their school year and moving on to the next grade, I thought and thought about what scripture passage I wanted to choose about leaving the nest. And in the end, I could find no better passage than the story of Adam and Eve. That's because, well, they leave the nest, but more importantly in this story, we see God as a wonderful example of a parent struggling with his children growing up and experiencing all the trials of parenthood. So in this story, we see seven steps that they go through, which when you look at them is something almost all of us can identify with, either as parents or from when we were kids. See, it starts with the big lie. It starts with the big untruth. Did you realize in the beginning of the story that God tells Adam something that isn't true? Did you realize that? In the beginning, before Eve comes along, we have Adam, or this earth person, wandering around all by themselves. And God says, see that tree over there? The tree of the knowledge of good and evil? Don't touch that. If you eat of it, you will die. But we know that's not true because both Adam and Eve eat of it, and they live. Do you see that? Yeah. Now, here's the thing. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil is a mirism. That's a word that occurs in Hebrew whenever you see something that has two opposite extremes, good and evil, young and old. Past and the future, the light and the dark. What it means is both of those extremes and everything in between. This is the knowledge of good and evil and everything in between. Everything that a person would learn, everything that a person could or should know or learn in their lifetime. This is all of the knowledge that we could attain as we grow through our years. And when we learn as kids and as adults, new things, there is always risk involved. And so as parents, we tend to sell our children things that are not true because we are not ready for them to experience the danger that comes with great knowledge. For example, how many people here have said or heard their parents tell them that you can't cross the street without holding someone's hand because you'll be hit by a car? How many people here have crossed the street recently and lived to tell the tale? Were you holding someone's hand at the time? No. How many people have heard, don't play with matches or you'll burn down the house? How many people have played with matches and the house is still standing? I played with matches as a child. I almost, but did not quite, set the entire load of laundry on fire. The house is still standing. Yeah. What about don't talk to strangers or you could be kidnapped? Yeah, have we heard this one? Or something like it? Yeah, how many people greeted a newcomer today? Are you still here? You have to get good grades. I love this one. You have to get good grades or you'll end up pumping gas for $5 an hour for the rest of your life. How many people got a C or worse at some point during their high school career? Yeah, we're still, how many people are making more than $5 an hour? Yeah. Okay, one of my all-time favorites. Don't smoke pot. It's a gateway drug, and you'll end up addicted to meth and dead in the gutter. I'm not going to ask how many people in this congregation are still alive. The point is, we tell our kids these lies because we know that they are not ready for all of the responsibility that comes with exposure to knowledge of the great wide world. And so we create this lovely garden where children are buffered, protected from the wide, wide world. We cook all their meals for them so they don't have to risk burning themselves on the stove. We hold their hands crossing the street. We put training wheels on their bicycles. We use Net Nanny on the computer. We make sure they never forget their sweater when they go outside. And sometimes, just for their own good, we create a little fib, a little falsehood, just a little facade, which works really, really well until, like when the snake suddenly comes to talk to Eve, a friend shows up and gives up the game. Okay? At one point, years ago, Faye lost a tooth. Wasn't her first tooth? Might not have even been her second, but it was a tooth. And she was so excited that when she lost it, I heard her yelling from across the house, "Mommy, Mommy, I lost a tooth, I lost a tooth." And I could hear her charging through the house. And when she was almost to me, she tripped. And the tooth flew out of her hand and went right down into the heater grate on the floor. Oh, she was in tears. Instantly, all that enthusiasm just dissolved into hysterics as she was trying to lift the grate off the floor. Now, this heater vent had not been used in decades. It was just a hole into the bottom of the floor filled with dust and debris and dog hair. And somewhere in there, we were never finding that tooth. Fear not. Supermom came up with a plan. And I said, "Don't worry, sweetie pie. Don't worry about it. See, the tooth fairy can get the tooth anyway. The tooth fairy is magical. The tooth fairy will still find that tooth and put money under your pillow tonight, even though you can't find it right now." Can I get a little round of applause? Thank you. Yes. Yes, I got A's sometimes in college. So, after I said this, thinking the whole problem was solved, my daughter said, "Oh, Mommy, I'm so relieved because I didn't even want the money. I just want my tooth back to show my friends. So just tell the tooth fairy to leave my tooth under the pillow instead of the quarter, okay?" So to make an exceptionally long 3-month story short, the tooth fairy and Faye corresponded for a while. "Tooth fairy's looking for it, honey," etc., etc., while I went on Craigslist and put out requests, wanted one human tooth, age 7. And I got responses. Nobody actually had a tooth, but I got a lot of sympathetic responses. "Oh, we're so riveted by your story," because I told them exactly what I told you. "We're praying for you," they said, "and sure hope that you find that tooth. Did you find one yet? Our family and I have been thinking about you and talking about you." I was getting email after email expressing sympathy from parents who knew what it was like to be caught in a lie with their children. Eventually, after about 3 months of this, someone came through with the tooth. Another child said, heard about the story and said, "Mom, she can have my tooth that I lost, you know, last year." And so I arranged to like drive out to Richmond and pick up a tooth. It appeared under my daughter's pillow. You can't tell her this when she comes back. She does not know any of this. It appeared under her pillow, and exactly 3 days later, she came back from school where she had seen her 11-year-old, or her cousin, and her cousin said, "You know your parents are just lying to you, right? The tooth fairy is not real. It's just your parents sneaking in at night, putting the money under your pillow." And she gave up the story. After 3 months of trying to keep the lie alive, she gave up the story. And that's exactly what the snake does. The snake goes, "Did God really say you must not eat of any tree in the garden?" Just like the friend, "Is it true that your mom never lets you do anything? Is it true that you're never allowed to stay out late? Is it true that your mom never lets you go out with boys or girls? Is it true that your mom never lets you wear makeup? That she won't even let you have your own cell phone? This is what, is it true your parents are still telling you that the tooth fairy is real?" And Eve tries to defend herself when the snake says this, and her God, but she's been misinformed, so she sounds kind of foolish. "Well, no, God said that, like, you know, we can eat anything we want. We just can't, just not that fruit, because if we touch it, we'll die." This is just like when we say, "No, I'm allowed to date boys. I'm just not allowed to hold hands because I could end up pregnant." Right? And the friend, the more worldly, mature friend says, "No way. Your parent told you that? Everybody knows that's not true." This is exactly what's going on when the snake says, "You're not going to die. God knows that when you eat from it, your eyes will be open and you will be just like God." And that's it. All it takes is one friend, just one kid at school, and all of a sudden, everything they thought they knew falls apart. Just one kid can cast doubt on everything, and then All of a sudden, the kids are thirsty for knowledge when they realize what they've been missing out on. And then they start wondering about playing with matches and holding hands and smoking cigarettes and reading Catcher in the Rye and wearing bell bottoms. And all this leads to the next stage, which is the suspicious silence. See, in the story of the Garden of Eden, God comes home from work. And she takes off her coat, and she hangs up her purse, and she puts down her briefcase and is like, "Kids, I'm home." And it's suspiciously silent. It's absolutely silent, and there are no kids to be found, and there's water everywhere, and the bathroom door is closed. Have we all been there? Mm-hmm. And God's like, "Where are you? Why is it so quiet in there? Why have you been in there so long? Why aren't you answering me? What are you doing in there?" And the kids suddenly appear wearing fig leaves, and they're like, "Nothing." Have we all seen the nothing? Have we all said the nothing? Mm-hmm. Nothing. I just suddenly got real modest for no reason. What's your problem? This is just like my friend who suddenly started wearing turtlenecks that covered her neck right after she went to the Rocky Horror Picture Show in the middle of July. Sure. And God knows exactly. Yeah, we all know exactly what happened. How many of us have been wearing the turtleneck in July? Come on. Really? Really? Thank you. Thank you. One person has the courage to speak the truth. Mm-hmm. And God knows exactly what happened. God knows exactly what happened, and she knows exactly who to blame too. See, at one point, I heard a suspicious silence in the bedroom. My girls had been put to bed, but there was a silence, but a rustling, but a silence, but a little giggling, but then more silence. And they were supposed to be asleep. The lights were out, and I knew something was up. I maybe didn't know all the details, but I knew they had something in there they weren't supposed to have. So I walked in with confidence and said, "Hand it over." Right? I didn't know what it was, but I knew they had something. "Hand it over." And they went like this. "Okay, Mom." And they handed over 14 books, 3 flashlights, 18 stuffed animals, and multiple pieces of food that they had stashed under their covers. I had to stop in the middle while they were handing me stuff and say, "You just hold on 1 second. Take this huge pile to the living room, dump it, and then go back so they could finish handing me stuff." The suspicious silence. You know what's going on. You know. So, the question is, who's to blame when the kids do things like this, when they learn these behavior? And that comes to number 5, which is, it's always someone else's kid. God knows who to blame. And they all blame each other. Did you notice that? The snake says, "He did it. He made me do it." No. Adam says, "Eve made me do it." Eve says, "The snake made me do it." Right? Okay. So she goes, "Who told you that you were naked? Did you eat from that tree after I told you not to?" And then says, "I don't want you hanging around with the snake anymore." It's in fancy language. There's some curse words involved, some cursing. But the long and short of it is, you don't get to hang around with that snake anymore. Don't be coming around here. My mother used to write the police blotter for our local paper. And she had did so since I was in middle school. And she used to come home from the police station where she would copy out all of the police calls so that she could translate them, make them anonymous, and then put them into the... So she would actually see the names and what had happened in the incident reports. But in the paper, she would publish, you know, a resident of Albany who lives on the block of Canes, you know, was involved in an altercation or whatever. And she would come home and we would be having dinner. And she would say, "You know those Smith kids?" She'd look at us. "You know those Smith kids? You know who I'm talking about? You know those Smith kids?" And we'd go, "Yeah." She'd say, "I don't want you hanging around with them anymore. You don't need to be hanging around with those Smith kids." Now, month to month, the name would change, and we would always have to go in the paper and look through it to try and figure out what it was they had done, because she wouldn't tell us. She wasn't allowed to reveal that. She'd just say, "You don't need to be hanging around those anymore." Because the assumption is that your kids are innocent. Your kids listen. Your kids are obedient. It's the other people's kids that are the troublemakers. So one day, Rosemary came home from school, kindergarten. She comes home from school and she cannot keep a straight face during dinner. She's snickering. She's giggling. She can't even chew her food because she's so busy giggling. And I finally say, "What is going on?" And she says, "I know the F word." She knows the F word. Now, my mom instincts by that point had been slightly honed. So instead of just lecturing her, something said, you know, just double check. When a kid says, "I know the F word," I said, well, what exactly is the F word, sweetie? Oh, and she goes into conniption fit. She's laughing so hard she can't even stay in her chair. And then she goes, "Wiener." That was the F word, wiener. And I remember my first thought was, who taught her that? I need to go have a talk with them. Not because someone else's child taught her this. And I wanted to go to her teacher and say, what kind of language are you allowing in your classroom? And if you must teach my child four-letter words, how come she can't tell her F's from her W's yet? I didn't know where to start, but I knew it was someone else's fault. Because it's always somebody else's fault when our children behave like that. So, then we get to the blame game. Once we identify the problem and the suspicious silence is broken and we're given the old stink eye, that's when we get to the blame game, which is exactly what we see with Adam blaming Eve and Eve blaming the serpent. I remember years ago when I was a child, my mother had people coming over and she told us to clean our room. And I had my own room and my brothers had their room and they had let it get completely out of hand and then they waited till the last second to clean it. And this resulted in a mad flurry the afternoon of. Mad flurry trying to clean it out. And in the process, they filled up the garbage can so no more could fit in, but they weren't done cleaning their room. Do we know children like this? Have we seen things like this? Okay. And I'm not revealing which brother it was because if they overheard this, they'd be very upset. So at a certain point, they just stop. They just stop. And my mother comes in and says, what's going on? How come you're not finished? And they said, well, we can't go any further. The garbage can is full. I guess we have no choice but to not do any more. And she says, well, if you had not let it get to this point and waited till the last second, you wouldn't be having this problem. And they looked her right in the eye and said, well, if you hadn't made us clean our room in the first place, this never would have happened either. Right? Adam blames Eve. Eve blames the snake. Snake's like, well, you weren't telling the truth in the first place. Now, here's the thing. Adam actually blames God when he says it, when he responds. When God says, who told you were naked? Did you eat of that tree? And Adam says, the woman that you put here with me. Do you hear that? The woman that you put here with me. She gave me some fruit. Did you hear that? That's what he says. The woman that you put here with me. She gave me some fruit. Now, he knew he wasn't supposed to eat of it. He was sitting there the whole time. It says specifically, she argues with the snake, then she takes some of the fruit, seeing that it was good to eat, and shared it with her husband, who was there with her. Did you hear him say anything about, I don't think this is a good idea, Mom told us not to? No. Does he say, I think this is, there's a rule about this, I'm going to tell on you? No. He eats it and says nothing. And later when they get caught, he says, the woman that you put here with me, it's your fault for putting her with me, and it's her fault for giving it to me. Do you see that? This is, how many people have done that? Come on. How many people have children who have done that? Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So finally we get to the curse, right? So in response to all of this misbehavior and all of these pointing the finger and playing the blame game and doing what they knew they weren't supposed to do, God loses it and just grounds them for the rest of their lives. Do you see that? That's it. You're grounded for the rest of your life and you can't come around here anymore. I'm calling your mother. I'm surprised you did not threaten to call the snake's mother and have a talk with her. You know what I mean? Okay. But he does it in a very interesting, very parental way. First, he curses the snake and declares that the snake is no longer allowed to be friends with Eve anymore. Second, he curses Adam, but he more, less curses and more throws him out of the house, because the end result is Adam has to get out and get a job. He makes the classic parental ultimatum. If you want to live under my roof, you'll live by my rules. If you don't want to live by my rules, then go get a job, and we'll see how well you do without your mother and I here to baby you along anymore. I'll tell you, it's no picnic out there. Get a haircut, get a real job. Your mother and I are not going to wash your fig leaves for you anymore. This is the threat. And he has to go out and toil now to feed himself. That is the end result. And finally, we come to Eve, who amazingly enough, and I cannot make this clear enough, God does not expressly curse Eve. I'm going to say that again. God never uses the word curse when he is talking with Eve. How many people thought that God cursed Eve? Yeah. We commonly believe that God curses Eve, but in fact, he does not curse Eve. With the Adam and with the snake, he uses the word curse. With Eve, no. In this part of the text, we got to get down to the nitty-gritty of the language, because it has been badly translated in just about every English version out there. God does not say that he will make the physical act of childbirth painful in order to punish her. What he says is that having children will be painful, but that she will still want to have them. And isn't that the truth?
Yeah.
Okay? Having children is a bittersweet act, because the more we love them and the more we want to protect them, the harder it is to let them go. The more we let them grow in their independence, the more we have to watch them struggle and falter. And the more they grow up, the more we understand that our job is done. And the closer they grow to having their own children, the more we know that they will suffer the same bittersweet pain of having children that we experienced. And yet we want to do it anyway. And we want them to do it so that we can have grandchildren and start the whole process over again. And it's really important to understand that, because I cannot believe in a God that would cause physical pain to all women as a punishment because someone didn't tell them the truth. This story is a wonderful story because God struggles as a parent just as we do. And Adam and Eve struggle as young people growing and maturing in their independence and their experimentation just as we all do. And God knows as he sends them out of the nest how hard it will be for both of them, but that they will find their own way and God will be with them. Adam will struggle to find a job and support himself and his family and will make his own way in the world, and it will be really, really hard. But he will survive. And Eve will struggle with the pain of having children and raising them and watching them grow and leave the nest just as God struggled. But she will survive the process and she will want to do it again. She has to. She has to. So I want to assure all of you parents and grandparents, you aunts and you uncles here today, that all of the children in your lives that are now transitioning in their education, embarking on new adventures, learning new things, questioning the things they've been told, meeting new people and experiences that will challenge them, they will not die. But their eyes may be opened. They will not die, but their eyes may be opened. For all those parents and grandparents, aunts and uncles watching and waiting anxiously from the sidelines and watching their babies leave the garden for the first time, take heart. God has been there and knows exactly what you're going through. Can I get an amen to that?